The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight I'd like to talk about a sutta, one sutta from the Buddha, the words of the Buddha that I particularly appreciate. It's the Kalama Sutta. It's a sutta that, in which the Buddha meets a group of people who have been hearing a lot of different teachings. They've been, the town that they live in is kind of in the midst of a crossroads, and all these different spiritual teachers have been coming through, and they're all saying different things. So they hear that the Buddha is going to come, and they have a habit of going and hearing the latest teacher who's coming through. And besides, they've heard a good report about the Buddha, so they decide to go listen to him, to ask him some questions. But instead of going to him and saying to him, "Tell us what you have to teach," what they instead say to him is, "You know, we sit here and all these teachers come through and they all tell us different things. Not only do they tell us different things," here I'll read some of this to you. "There are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. For us, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood." So their confusion comes about because they're hearing contradictory statements from these teachers. And in the time of the Buddha, there were a number of different sects that proclaimed different truths. Some claimed that there was no cause and effect, that everything was random. Some claimed that that there is cause and effect, that everything is actually deterministic. Others claimed that, make great statements about the universe, the cosmos is eternal, or the cosmos is finite, or the soul is infinite, or the soul and the body are two things, or the soul and the body are one thing. They made all these pronouncements, and they all contradict each other. Many of them contradicted each other. So these poor people, the Kalamas, were quite confused about these teachings. And the Buddha, his response to this initially was, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter." So he first he acknowledges the situation and he tells him, "Yeah, you know, this is a confusing situation." And he then goes on to offer them some suggestions. So they're asking him basically, how do we know who speaks truth? How do we know who speaks falsehood? This is confusing to us. We don't know who to believe. And here he gives what is a very famous response, often quoted. He says, "Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reflection on reasons, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think this person is our teacher. So he's listing a bunch of different ways that are not guaranteed to produce truth, that these 10 ways can be, things can come out of these 10 ways that produce either truth or falsehood. So these 10 ways can roughly be broken into three categories. The first four are basically based on tradition. Don't go only by tradition. So these include oral tradition, lineage of teaching, hearsay, or popular consensus or a popular opinion, or a collection of scriptures. So the second group is based on reasoning or the way we think about things. So that includes logical reasoning, inferential reasoning, reflectance on reasoning, and acceptance after thinking about something. The third way is based on personal authority, which includes the seeming competence of the speaker and because the person is your teacher. So these things, not putting our faith in things that come out of these categories, actually undercuts many of the ways that we typically put our belief in things. Based on tradition, our culture tells us, feeds us what it wants us to believe. We form our opinions based on what our friends tell us, what our parents have told us, based on our conditioning, based on our cultural conditioning. Many of our beliefs come into being. For example, one popular opinion in our culture tells us that in order to be happy, we need to buy things. There's one advertisement that I think I've seen it once. It's this guy, he's kind of surrounded. It's guy sitting in the middle of a whole bunch of stuff. And the caption on the, I think he's sitting in a meditation posture or something. I have a vague recollection of this. And the caption says something like, "In order to be one with everything, you have to have one of everything." So, you know, when we actually live this opinion, this value, we see actually this isn't what makes us happy. We often think things are true simply because they've been in the culture for a long time. But the Buddha says that tradition is not sufficient for a good enough reason. It's not a good enough reason to say this is true or to believe it without further reflection. Likewise with reasoning. We put a lot of faith in our reasoning. We put a lot of faith in how we think about things. We come to conclusions about things. Well, if such and such is true, then that must be true. We believe things because they make logical sense to us, because we've thought about them, we've pondered them. But we don't often consider that how we make these logical inferences is based upon, or what these logical inferences are. What these logical inferences are based upon. They can be based upon erroneous beliefs from the outset. It's actually quite amazing the depth of misperception that we operate under and then make assumptions and make inferences out of those misperceptions. I'll just mention one of those misperceptions, that we, even though we actually sort of know that things are impermanent, we act as though things are permanent. And we make decisions, make inferences, reason about things out of that assumption. So perhaps our conclusions are logical, but they may be based on erroneous assumptions. With respect to personal authority, it's so tempting at times to want to put our faith in someone just because we think we see that they seem to be competent as a speaker, or because we believe that they have some authority. It seems to be a very human wish to find someone who you can believe and put your faith in them so that we don't have to make the decisions ourselves. There was one study I read about recently that kind of indicates how we really like, or there's a way in which we really get pulled towards personalities or people who seem to have authority. It was a study about coming to decisions. And the study used a jar of beans. It was a jar of beans. And the decision that a group of people together were supposed to make was how many beans are in the jar. And what the researchers discovered is that if you asked everybody individually what they thought and didn't have them consult with each other, just asked everybody individually and then averaged the number, you got a better guess than any one of the individual numbers. But if you put the factor of discussion in the room and ask them to come up to a group consensus about how many beans are in the jar, usually what happened is that there was one person who was very persuasive, who had a seeming sense of authority, who kind of, you know, had a way of saying things or a way of presenting things that convinced the others to follow their choice. And so then everybody agreed with that person. And it was it was just a random guess, basically, that the average of the guesses was way better than going with any one of the individual's guesses. So, but we have that mentality of wanting to follow somebody who seems like they know what they're doing. So what does the Buddha suggest? What does the Buddha suggest for us? So he goes on, after giving all of these ways that you, it's not so helpful to go by all of these various ways. And he says, but when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. But when you know for yourselves these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. Now, I think this is really interesting because in reflecting on this afternoon as I was thinking about this talk, I realized that the Buddha actually he's kind of taking a left turn in a way. He's not answering the question about how do we know whether something is true or false. He's saying, when you know things are wholesome, when you know things lead away from suffering, you should practice them. He doesn't say you should believe them. When you know things are unwholesome, when you know things when you know things lead towards suffering, you should abandon them. So his whole approach here isn't so much about truth and falsehood. It's about what's effective for abandoning suffering. What's effective for cultivating happiness? So this brings in a kind of an ethical component to the teaching as well. That he is pointing to ethical conduct as a guideline for us in terms of our spiritual inquiry. Things that are wholesome are things that lead us towards happiness, away from suffering. Things that are unwholesome are things that lead us towards suffering. The roots of the unwholesome in the understanding of the Buddha are greed, aversion, and delusion. When we act out of greed, aversion, and delusion, we tend towards winding ourselves into situations that land us in suffering. So the Buddha actually asks the Kalamas this. He says, what do you think? When greed, hatred, and delusion arise in a person, is it for his welfare or harm? For his harm. And likewise, when non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion arise in a person, is that for his welfare or harm? For his welfare. So it's very simple here that he's pointing to this simple kind of criterion through which we should evaluate what we engage in, what we practice. Not necessarily what we believe. And this also says to me that we need to engage in a practice. We need to engage, not simply sit around and listen. Oh yes, these things are wholesome. Greed, aversion, and delusion are unwholesome. Well, that's a nice thing to hear, but what does it do for us unless we put it into action? So the entire effect of this set of teachings is actually to encourage us to investigate what we're doing, investigate not only teachings that we receive, but our own beliefs. The first part the Buddha suggested checking out is teachings. Don't necessarily just go by oral tradition. Check it out in your experience. If those teachings are applied in your experience, do they lead to suffering and harm or to happiness? Likewise with what you believe, what you think. Check it out. Don't simply believe it because you've come to the logical conclusion. So this teaching really encourages us to, in a very radical way, explore our own beliefs, our own views. Sometimes this teaching is called the Buddha's Charter for Free Inquiry, or Charter on Free Inquiry. And to some extent, it definitely encourages us to not just accept things at face value, but to bring the teaching into action and look at the causes and effects. What are the effects of behaving in this way? But it's not simply a teaching that says we should behave in a certain way because we like that particular way, because it is in alignment with our particular views and opinions. It actually suggests you also question your views and opinions. As Tan Jeff says about this, our own preferences are not to be followed simply because they seem logical or resonate with one's own feelings. Instead, any view or belief must be tested by the results it yields when put into practice. And to guard against the possibility of any bias or limitations in one's own understanding of these results, they must further be checked against the experience of people who are wise. That's an aspect of what the Buddha said. He said, just to restate this, when you know for yourselves these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to happiness, then you should practice them. So it's not simply about just exploring things in our own way, because if left to our own devices, we tend to kind of follow our own habits and patterns. So we need something to check that, some way to kind of break in to our own familiar views, familiar habits, familiar patterns. Some way to kind of check, are these views skillful or unskillful? You know, when we hold beliefs tightly, we limit ourselves. When we hold a certain view, we tend to then see things in terms of that view. Evidence comes in that corroborates that view. A kind of it's an example in my own life. I used to have the view that I was basically a miserable person. And a lot of what I experienced confirmed that view. And even when I was happy, the mind didn't take that to be contradiction of the fact that I was, or didn't take it as undercutting the fact that I was miserable. I mean, the mind actually would say, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I know that really I'm miserable. So, you know, the mind has the capacity to hold views and just find the evidence that supports those views. It's a very strong pattern that we have. So beliefs that we hold actually can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So this teaching about looking at what's wholesome, looking at what is unwholesome, the Buddha also gave instructions to his own son around this. And this, I think, is interesting when I reflected on this also. The teaching that he's giving to the Kalamas, he's giving this teaching to somebody who hasn't particularly heard his teaching before. And he's giving them the foundational teaching around pay attention to your actions and check into whether they're causing harm and suffering or not. If they cause harm, stop doing them. If they don't cause harm, if they lead towards happiness, keep engaging in them. And he actually gave this same teaching to his 7-year-old son. And I think it really points to the foundational aspect of this teaching. To his son, he gave this same teaching in a more rigorous form. He told him, before you engage in an action, reflect on whether it will cause harm. If you think or you see that it will cause harm, don't do it. While you're doing an action, check and see, is it causing harm to yourself, to others, or to both? So this is bringing in a relational component here too. It's not simply looking at, does it cause harm to myself? It's, does it cause harm to others as well? If the action that you're engaging in is causing harm to self or other or both, stop doing it. And then not only stopping there, he suggests reflecting after an action has been finished. After you've finished an action, reflect and look back. Has anybody been harmed? If that has happened, you should cease from doing that in the future. So this teaching is foundation. It's a foundational teaching for our practice to look at our actions and how they impact the world. To the Kalamas, he also encouraged them to engage in this connection by cultivating the qualities of love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity towards all beings. And he said at the end of the sutta, when you have made your mind free of enmity, free of ill will, uncorrupted and pure, there are 4 assurances in this very life. And this part is kind of interesting because it goes back to the beginning of the sutta where the Kalamas are talking about all these different views that these different teachers have come through with. So the Buddha says, and I'll just read this and then I'll discuss it a little bit. The first assurance he has won is this. If there's another world, and if good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, It is possible that with the breakup of the body after death, I shall arise in a good destination in a heavenly world. The second assurance he has won is this: if there is no other world, and if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit and yield results, still right here in this very life, I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. The third assurance he has won is this: suppose evil befalls the evildoer, then, as I do not intend evil for anyone, how can suffering afflict me as one who does no evil deed? The fourth assurance he has won is this: suppose evil does not befall the evildoer, then right here I see myself purified in both respects. And the comment on that one, the footnote on that one, says that basically he, in refraining from doing evil, he is purified by not doing evil. So basically what this is pointing to is the beliefs are not so important. That he's basically gone through four of the kind of standard views of the day that kind of contradict each other and said, if you just engage in this teaching that I've given you, if you follow this acting on wholesome and refraining from unwholesome, whatever those beliefs are, whether they are true or false, you will have good results. So what is believed isn't as important as how you engage. And for me, this is, I love this teaching in a way, because for me, being of a kind of skeptical mind in a way, or kind of with a scientific kind of inclination, what I see the Buddha as telling me is, come and see, try it for yourself, run the experiment and see what happens. Try this teaching and see for yourself, if you engage this way, what is the cause, what is the effect? If you engage in this practice, engage in bringing your mindfulness to your actions and observing how the consequences play out, you will see that the consequences, the kind of the truth in a way of what the Buddha is saying, that the consequences of acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion lead to suffering. The consequences of acting out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion lead to peace, lead to happiness, lead to contentment. And you can see this moment to moment. So for me, this has been helpful in my own practice. When I run up against a kind of a phase of doubt in my practice, where it's like, well, what does this have to do with, you know, what do these teachings have to do with me? Or how does this work anyway? You know, trying to figure out how these teachings work or how these teachings apply to me. I think about this sutta and I think the Buddha didn't ask me to believe him. He asked me to try it and see. Run the experiment. See what happens to you. Come and see. One of the qualities of the Dharma, ehi passi ko, means basically, come and see. Try it for yourself. So we gain confidence, actually, in the teachings as we engage. we see for ourselves the benefits. We learn for ourselves the truth of this foundational teaching, which actually, as a foundation, it's a foundational teaching, but actually the investigation into greed, aversion, and delusion takes us all the way to complete freedom from suffering. So we have a few minutes if there's any comments or questions.
What does it mean to act out of aversion?
Well, aversion, do you know what aversion is? Okay. Aversion is basically the quality of the mind that says, I don't like this. So, something comes up in the mind like, or something comes up in experience that's unpleasant in experience. The typical movement of mind towards something unpleasant in our experience is to want to push it away. So, acting out of aversion is, there's a whole host of emotional reactions that are kind of born out of that wanting to push away quality that include things like fear, irritation, annoyance, anger, hatred, hostility, rage. So a whole host of mental qualities that come based on that dislike of something unpleasant. And acting out of that quality, acting out of aversion, means basically following through on an impulse that arises out of one of those states of mind. So following through on an impulse of anger, for instance, might mean speaking harshly to someone when we're angry at them. That's just one small example. And I think you probably know from your own experience, that tends to lead us towards conflict, towards suffering. So that's what the Buddha was pointing to, that when we act out of those kind of qualities, we end up in suffering and potentially harming either ourselves or others.
Can we include fear in this set of things you thought about aversion?
Yes. Yeah.
Part of.
Yeah. The quality of fear. I mean, the quality of the wanting to push away when something unpleasant arises. It kind of has two basic flavors to it. One is kind of a lashing out to kind of get rid of the thing. You know, it's kind of, that's the angry energy. So it's like there's this unpleasant thing in the environment. It's like, let's get rid of it somehow. And that's the angry movement. The other kind of movement is to take yourself out of the situation, which is more the fear movement. It's like, well, I don't want to be in this state, so in this situation, so I'm going to get out of here. So that's where the fear comes in. So yeah, it's in that same place. Yeah. So it's 9:00. We need to stop. So, may you all bring the practice into your lives, engaging with this exploration to see for yourselves.